but I got to save this one. So this is our little office.
Roach Ellington, fondly known as Ms. E, purchased some property over at 39th and Chestnut in Kansas City's Oak Park neighborhood.
We bought these two properties here, that lot, and a corner lot.
One of the houses has broken windows, and another is still boarded up and locked. A spray-painted sign on the door says dangerous, and it's signed by the city.
Well, right now we're talking about just the cutting of the grass and keeping people out.
Back in 2016, one of the houses was on the market for a dollar, part of the city's attempt to get people to rehab some of the most dangerous vacant houses in the urban core. She missed the deadline to apply, but she's not really sure she could have afforded it anyway, considering one of the requirements to buy a $1 house was having $8,500 in your bank account. Over time, she says she's put about $2,000 into the properties.
Which is not bad, but what's really bad about it is we're getting ready to try to do a rehab on these houses, but what we're having the problem is because these grounds are so toxic, you know, you have asbestos in most of these houses, so that's a major, major problem for us.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today's show is all about empty houses. Why they're empty, how that affects communities, and what's being done about it in the urban core as well as small towns. Let's start with someone who's been looking at the issue nationally for a while. Ryan McMakin used to work in the Colorado Division of Housing. He's recently written an article for Business Insider where the headline boldly proclaims, America's urban-rural divide doesn't really exist. Hi, Ryan.
Good morning.
Okay, so what is it that we're missing about the urban-rural divide, and what do empty houses have to do with it?
Well, the title perhaps overstates the case a little bit. There certainly is a difference, and there is a political divide, a cultural divide, lots of divides between rural and urban. However, what I was noting in the article is that there's just as much a divide between suburban and urban, and that there's a lot of movement between all of these areas. And what that's doing nationwide in a lot of places is as people move to the suburbs, which remain popular in spite of all the talk we hear about everybody preferring to move back to the urban core, as people move to the suburbs, they're emptying up real estate and houses in both rural and in older suburbs and in urban core areas.
And they've been doing that for a while, right?
Oh, yes. Well, of course, the initial wave of suburbs, new suburbs being built in the post-war era has long been a topic of discussion. But what we find in a lot of cases, these older suburbs from, say, the 20s and the teens even, are now starting to see an emptying in many cases. And what's been new over the past 20 years or so is that it's no longer just well-to-do people that are moving to the suburbs. It's now more medium-income and medium-low-income people, whites, blacks, Hispanics, all of those groups moving to the suburbs now. So now the look of the suburbs is changing, but that's leaving some empty housing behind.
So what are... Those are like the big trends that are causing lots of houses to be empty. What are some specific types of events that cause like a house to be sitting
sure.
empty?
Well, when we look down at the specific level, we learned a lot about this during the financial crisis back in 2008, 2009, really even going back to 2006 or so, as foreclosures started to really build. And we looked at that and found, of course, there's any number of reasons, but it's usually around issues of job loss, of divorce often, where he had a two-income household, which is now a one-income household, and they simply can't pay the mortgage anymore. But also, in many cases, it can simply be a more neighborhood-wide effect where overall demand for the neighborhood is going down, and so then the person who's in a specific house realizes now the home is losing value. They're tied into a mortgage that has them paying a certain amount every month, but they're realizing, well, I'm never going to be able to sell this house for what I owe on. It's just declining in value. So then they just walk away from the property in many cases.
So how big would you say this problem of empty houses is?
Well, it totally depends on the local situation. So if you have a city like Seattle or Denver, yes, you might have some pockets, some neighborhoods where there are some abandoned houses. But for the most part, if you have a big influx of population, even those less stylish, less in-demand neighborhoods are going to start to fill up as the most in-demand neighborhoods. They will then gentrify outward, if you will. But there are some places where we're seeing essentially what's the opposite of gentrification, right? People, the value of that real estate is going to zero, in many, sometimes even negative, where it's just costing you money to hold on to the property.
Wait, where are you seeing the opposite of gentrification?
Right. Well, we're seeing that more, not in the West and not in the South. We're seeing it's following those general migration patterns where we're looking at the old Rust Belt, some areas in the Midwest, some of those cities where you're seeing more modest growth or even some declines in overall home prices and demand. But even then, of course, it's limited to specific neighborhoods. Because if we look at, say, Kansas City, for example, using the Case-Shiller Home Price Index, we find that overall as a metro area, home prices have returned to where they were at peak levels. But of course, that's not true for every neighborhood.
So there are some neighborhoods, I mean, if you imagine gentrification to be a good thing, which I know is definitely not a sort of like widely, like 100% accepted view.
Controversial, yes.
But like if you imagine that to be a good thing, would you say that there are neighborhoods then like left out of gentrification?
Oh, yes, definitely. Often it's older neighborhoods that are seen as not being close to any services that new people moving in would want. The shopping's bad. It's not close to transportation that people want. And so those neighborhoods, because of the surrounding environment and the amenities available, tend to be the last place that people will finally push into. And so for now, those neighborhoods that aren't seen as connected to the larger city and its services, they're not seeing gentrification.
All right, Ryan, stay with us. We're going to bring you back, but I want to zoom in on this with some people from our area, okay?
Great.
Dale Fugate is the unofficial watchman for the McCoy neighborhood in Independence. More officially, he is the Neighborhood Association president. Welcome to the show, Dale.
Well, first off, I'm the president of McCoy Park Neighbors, and we are a Kansas City, Missouri neighborhood. We're over here on the east side, just up out of the Blue River.
I apologize for those lines can be tricky. I really apologize for that.
tell me
about the McCoy neighborhood and what it's like there.
Well, we are very much, have always been an immigrant neighborhood, and our housing stock is probably very small. We range anywhere from, 800 square feet up to, at the most, 1,500 square feet for some of the two stories. So we're a very small thing, and we went from basically it being emptied out to being filled up with Hispanics. So we're about 50% Hispanic, 20% white, 20% black, and about 5 to 8% Asian and others. So
when
that kind of gives you a little idea.
When you're just hanging out in your neighborhood, help me picture what that's like. Like, what there is to do, or yeah, just what it looks like.
Well, our neighborhood, what there is to do. We're a neighborhood of families now. Like I said, we emptied out. Now the families have returned, so we have a lot of kids and stuff. We also have a lot of basic issues with blight and different things like that that we work to address. And, we've got a brand new park we just put in over here for the McCoy School. When Kansas City closed that down in 2010 and tore the building down, we lobbied hard to get a park in there. And we got the Kansas City Parks Department to take it over. And now we've got kind of an attractive space area. We're actually doing a little fundraising and doing some different things. So if you want to go to our website, which is McCoy Friends and Amigos at blogspot.com, you can read all about us.
Well, yeah.
That's the best place. If you want to know what my neighborhood looks like, go there, because we've got pictures of people doing stuff all over the neighborhood.
Well, Dale.
We're a dynamic neighborhood. We're poor, but we're not downtrodden.
When I mention empty houses, what does that mean to you? What do you think of?
We have had a number of problems with investors who walked away from houses, and it was really got pretty bad about 5 years ago. I know on my block, about a quarter of the houses were empty, and we've started coming back. I mean, I'm seeing now even the land bank houses that we have sold, they've sold two or three in our neighborhood. So investors are coming back into the neighborhood. And some of them, like here on 14th Street down a block away. We had an investor house that they just walked away from it. And
why did the investors walk away?
It's you got me. One, we got there at a point where it cost more to sell the house. You know, when a house, some of these bank owned properties went for $5,000 or less, and it would just cost more to sit there and market it and sell it than it would to just walk away from it. And that was, you know, kind of the way it was at the time.
So what happens, you know, in the places where these houses are? I mean, what's going on with them? Do they cause problems in the neighborhood?
Well, the ones where they're abandoned are, we have a few problems with squatters and stuff, and we've been fighting that and making sure the city gets in and deals with those issues. And we have problems, of course, with dumping on them, and they're overgrown. Most of them are not well maintained, so we have to come in and try to address those issues. So it is, when you have one on your block, it kind of pulls down the whole block.
Can you describe that a little more, how it pulls down the whole block? Maybe with just an example?
If you turn corner, I always told people to come in on the west side on my block, because that's the one where all the nice houses, we've got good yards, and we're doing, you know, we've got a garden. And then we had down on the other end, we had an empty house or two, and they were basically, the lots were grown up with weeds, you know, above your head. There would be big piles of trash in the front yard where people had dumped, you know, just take throw mattresses and couches and stuff. So if you came in one side, you looked like you were in the best neighborhood in Kansas City. If you come in the other side, it was like you were in the most blighted neighborhood in Kansas City. Yet it was the same block.
So the city tried this program where they were going to sell houses for a dollar, hoping people would fix them, buy them. Was that popular in your neighborhood?
We really only had one house that qualified, and it didn't really qualify.
What does it mean to qualify?
Well, it was on the dangerous buildings list. But what it didn't qualify was it has so many issues. It's what we call the house in the hole. And it's down there, there was an old rock quarry, and some brothers built a brick house. They were bricklayers, and they built like three stories up to street level. And there's no way to get in it. And you go down there right now, and it looks like there's a spring running out from underneath the house. There's water coming out from underneath the house from a natural spring, and just all kinds of issues. So, yeah, you could have bought the house for a dollar, but then, you know, you'd need $500,000 to turn it into a livable house. So it just, like I said, qualified but didn't qualify.
Yeah.
That was our only dollar house on that program. You know, you start taking some of these houses like that where you basically have to go in and strip them to the studs and stuff. You've got to have a little money to do it. So it's not it wasn't a free deal.
Let's talk to one of our callers about this. Scott's calling from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Scott.
Hello, how are you?
Good. How are you? What can you share?
Well, I've been in the housing business. I bought and sold many of these houses, and some I've gotten for free. But let me tell you, the big problem here is the development code, which is the driving force of the wine of Kansas City, Missouri, and unified government, was developed in the 1960s. And at the time, this is back when they were trying to protect the trade industries such as carpenters, plumbers, electricians. For example, I got a house here I bought for very, very cheap. I had an estimate for plumbing work of $4,000. I was able to do the work myself for $400. So I hope the mayors of Kansas City, Missouri and Kansas City, Kansas are listening, that they need to rethink this whole process, because what would be ideal would be if I, as an ordinary Joe, could go in and get a permit to do my plumbing or electrical or whatever, and let the city come out and inspect it, just as they would inspect Acme Electric or Bob Hamilton, and then let it pass or fail based on that. But when you have to hire licensed contractors, the cost goes through the roof, and this is what's killing the redevelopment of affordable housing in both of these cities.
So like the idea that DIY type people wouldn't be able to just come in and use blood, sweat, and tears in the place of dollars.
Right. There's a new type of plumbing called PEX, and it's a flexible pipe, and there's a metal attachment that you can turn a valve or whatever that's called shark bite. Jen, I could teach you how to connect these things within 30 seconds.
You are perhaps overestimating my abilities, but go on.
They're extremely easy, extremely easy. You can buy them at Home Depot. And you don't need to hire somebody to come install copper pipes and then run a torch. And this is what was happening. People would set their house on fire because they didn't know how to run a torch. But the bottom line is that, you know, they need to allow the average person to get their own permit, to do their own work, because I can go to Habitat. I can buy, you know, discounted insulation, et cetera, and be able to let these people do the work themselves, come in and inspect it. Leavenworth does this. They have a policy that if you can buy a house, you can do all the work yourself. The only rule is you have to stay there for 1 year. After 1 year, then you can sell the house.
So that people aren't just trying to flip fast. Well, Scott, thank you so much for calling and sharing that insight.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Well, I want to bring someone else in on this. We've got Margaret May with us here, and Margaret is with us from the Ivanhoe neighborhood in Kansas City. Hi, Margaret.
Hello.
Talk to me about empty houses in your neighborhood and whether what you're hearing kind of resounds for you.
Well, one of the greatest challenges that we have in Ivanhoe at this time is the vacancy rate, and that's either a vacant house or a vacant lot. And a number of the houses can be rehabbed. They were strongly built. I heard mention of taking them down to the studs. We really highly recommend when a person gets one of these houses that they take them down to the studs and actually insulate properly, because in the old days they didn't insulate, and quite often the older homes have very high utility bills. But vacant houses are indeed a problem, and in addition to the things that have been mentioned already, they also attract squatters. And in the central part of the city where Ivanhoe is located, quite often some of these people you see out on the corners panhandling, they have actually broken into one of the vacant houses, and they're living in those houses.
It's interesting you should mention that. I mean, something that you will notice people kind of like suggesting as a pie in the sky kind of dream is like, okay, we have tons of empty houses in this country. We also have a homelessness problem. Why can't we just get these two things together? And it sounds like in a totally illicit way, those two things are getting together, which not everyone would hear as a problem. Why is it a problem?
Well, quite often the squatters in particular that move into the houses, they have trash all over the place. Quite often, I don't know whether it's intentional or accidental, fires end up getting set to the houses. And because back in the day, houses were built so closely together, if there's a house fire in one, quite often it affects the houses on either side. And just frankly, having people that have broken into something and they don't really care about it, and the people that have to live next door to that, that's a problem.
Well, talk to me also about renters versus owners and how that might play into this.
Well, we have about a 50% rental rate in Ivanhoe now. Our goal is to get up to a 70% home ownership rate. As a rule, people that own their own homes take better care of them. They realize they have an investment. But we also are very aware that renters, everybody can't own or shouldn't own their own home. My husband and I have owned our own home since 1960, but my parents never owned a home. And I don't remember them ever tearing up any place that we lived. But there are just a number of things that we need to do with renters to make sure that they're responsible and understand the need to be a part of the neighborhood.
I'm curious, though, about also responsibility for owners. Ms. E., who we heard from earlier, she's buying houses in the Oak Park neighborhood, and she had this to say about faraway property owners who don't have a vested interest in what's happening around their houses.
This is what really gets me. We had, right here where this lot is, where all that grass is up there, we had girls get raped up there. Prostitution is horrible with drugs. those lots belong to somebody in Paris, and we can't get them to relinquish.
You know, is that happening in your neighborhood?
We have some of that as well, and I must give a lot of credit to Legal Aid. We've worked closely with them through the years, and they've been very helpful in reaching out to and finding these absentee owners that live in Paris or wherever. And in some instances, we've even had properties that have been donated to us through the work we've done with Legal Aid.
Ms. E also says that people's attitudes toward property in her neighborhood is changing.
So we have people that's come here that maybe Miss Ann rented Mr. Dow's house for 30 years, and now Mr. Dow's children are coming back to get their homes. Well, they can put in the swimming pools and all that because they're rent-free. So you have the haves and the have-nots occupying the same space, and it's pushing the have-nots out. Instead of saying, let's rebuild together, we're just going to do what we do.
Are there property owners who hadn't been very interested in what they had who are kind of suddenly like getting a twinkle in their eye about these homes that have been standing empty or possibly have had renters for a while?
I don't have personal awareness of that. We're welcoming of people, homeowners, people coming and living in the homes in Ivanhoe. Great if someone can put in a swimming pool.
Well, Dale, what about you? Is there an issue as far as like changing attitudes toward your neighborhood, who owns, who rents, all of that?
Well, we are, like I say, we're an immigrant neighborhood, and so we do smaller housing. You know, we're not like, there's some neighborhoods over on the east side that have some tremendously nice big bone houses. You go over on Prospect Corridor, where, you know, you can have gentrification, or you can have people come in. You know, if they were a mile west, they'd be a $1 million house over in Valentine, and you can pick them up for dollars, you know, for a lot less. And if you're a little adventuresome, you can live in a good neighborhood and have your $1 million house for $700 a month mortgage payment.
Dale, thank you so much for joining this conversation. I really appreciate your being here with us from the McCoy neighborhood. And you can call 816-235-2888 to tell us how empty houses are affecting your community. We'd also love to hear from someone who's bought a dollar house in Kansas City. When we return, a look at empty houses in nearby rural communities. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about empty houses, how they got that way, how they're affecting communities, and why it's so hard to do something new with them. Call 816-235-2888 with your story. Now I want to talk to John Hackmeister. He's a sculptor, and for a long time he ran the Garden of Eden folk art site in Lucas, Kansas, just a few hours west of Kansas City. I say just a few hours west of Kansas City, but I mean, in the grand scheme of things, a few hours, whatever. He also owns a house in rural Kansas. And John, your grandfather built that house?
Yes, that's correct.
Tell me about the town.
He rebuilt it. Well, that's Natoma, Kansas. And he rebuilt the house in 1905. There was actually an older structure there before that.
So
it is. Oh, go on.
No, I go on and tell the story.
Well, it's and the unfortunate thing is that the house is breaking down. It's a stone house, and like a lot of stone houses out there, they do have some issues. And if it rains and water starts building up, and especially on a lot of houses out there, if there's heavy hailstorms that has knocked out the shingles, the houses go down. The walls blow out pretty fast. The unfortunate thing is that there's just nobody out there. Even though we love the house, I'm over 200 miles away. I can't afford to fix it.
Can you explain, like, why isn't that worth the investment?
Well, the problem with a house like that is that they and this happens to many houses in two-thirds of Kansas, the western two-thirds of Kansas. There, if people aren't living in the houses, that it's hard to maintain them. It's hard to get people to live in some of those old houses. There's no insulation. It's difficult in a stone house to insulate it. The wiring is almost always substandard. So it costs thousands of dollars. It costs probably at least $25,000 just to fix the wall that's blowing out in this house. So you fix that wall, and then what happens when another part of the wall starts going out? You know, I mean, it's a difficult decision, and a lot of people who have generations on those farms face the very same situation. Like, what do we do because we're not there? And some of those houses end up getting vandalized too, so because they're empty for so long.
So for you, I mean, it seems like if your grandfather built this house, and I mean, I'm guessing he lived there, and then did your parents live there too?
They did. I lived there until I was, I think I was about 7 or 8 when we moved into town, because it is out in the country, and so we moved into town. Now my parents have died, and so we're fixing up a house in town, and like many of the towns out there, there's fewer and fewer houses. The older houses, if anybody wants to move into one of those towns, then there's not a real economic incentive to do so. Farms are getting larger, so there's less reasons for people to be in those towns. They'll pick a house that's empty from the 1960s rather than a house from 1905, just because the 1960s houses are easier to move into.
But so, this is a house that you spent the first years of your life living in, that your parents lived in, that your grandfather essentially rebuilt. And even with that level of emotional attachment, you're not sure what to do with it. It's hard to imagine a situation where someone would be more motivated than you.
It's very true. And I live north of Lawrence, and I rebuilt a house that I live in now and added on to it. And I also own the former African Methodist Church in North Lawrence, which is a very old building. And it takes a huge amount of time and money to work on those buildings. You just keep finding more and more things to do. So if you're over 200 miles away from a building, there's a point where you just have to let it go.
So this is kind of that migration issue that our expert was telling us about earlier, this idea that as people have moved in large numbers, that there's just nobody to take care of these places. But a few years back when I met you, I was visiting you in Lucas, Kansas, where you have been really invested in turning around that town. And you've been doing that through the Garden of Eden, which is this grassroots art site that's been there for a long, long time. And a lot of the houses in that town had just suffered hail damage from just a giant storm. And you were really worried about it because that's one of those moments, right, where a house sitting empty now has a hole in the roof and nobody's going to fix it.
And some of those houses are now gone. Unfortunately, some of them, there just was no way to do anything about it. People owned the property. They felt the people who owned it weren't even living in town anymore. And there was some government funding to tear some of those houses down because they were just getting so decrepit. But it's a sad thing.
In Lucas, though, I guess what I'm wondering about is that there's this dream there of attracting artsy types to this folk art destination, and each house that gets destroyed in a hailstorm and becomes truly uninhabitable, that's one more place that won't ever become a bed and breakfast or an artist's retreat. You know what I'm saying?
It's very true, and it's a real concern that I'm very concerned about Lucas. Lucas is a vibrant town, and there are a number of artists who do live in town and who have purchased empty buildings, empty commercial buildings downtown. The problem is, now Lucas doesn't have a grocery store. The town you know, artists can only do so much because there's, unless there's a real economic incentive, artists can't afford to live there either. So it's a tough thing. We've talked about it a lot. We've discussed what happens to the Garden of Eden over a long period of time, and the town is really tough about hanging in there, but the town keeps losing population.
Let's hear from someone else who might be able to relate to this on the Missouri side. Shirley Taylor is with us from Orrick, which is a very small town north of Kansas City. She used to be the mayor, and Shirley, Orrick has its own housing stock problem, right?
Yes, we do. I think like most rural communities, very small community, and we have got several homes that, especially since the tornado in 2014, there was people that abandoned the homes, maybe didn't have insurance. Also, the economy really affected it because there was a lot of people at that point that felt like being closer to their jobs would be more beneficial to them. But we are trying to address some of these problems here, and we have a new mayor that's just really encouraging people to want to live here in different ways by, you know, trying to get some of these homes renovated and someone interested in doing something about them.
What is standing in the way of getting the homes renovated? I mean, the current mayor, I should say, he tried to talk me into moving to Orrick. And when I asked him how much a house there would cost, he told me that I wouldn't be able to find a house there. So it seems like getting the houses fixed would be a pretty important first step.
Well, and I think that is true. There are most of the homes here that are vacant are older homes and maybe a little smaller than we would like to encourage young people here that has a family. We have a wonderful school system, and we would also like to find a developer. When the tornado hit, we had a low-income housing area, and that has been all torn down and cleaned up. Be a perfect place to put in like duplexes or something like that for young families. And if we could find a developer that would be interested in doing this, this is some of the things that we're trying to address. And we actually have got a committee, community enhancement group put together. We've just really started working on some of this. So it's kind of in the early process of trying to get some things done.
But Shirley, tell me how...
Yeah, we would offer tax incentive, but I think we would do things like that to encourage people maybe to develop some different, you know, housing here for younger families.
Shirley, tell me how abandoned homes are affecting your city's, your town's dreams.
Well, I think there's some homes that either have been abandoned or really has not been anything done to them since then. And they're like some of these sitting in very, very nice neighborhoods where people really do work on their properties. And so we're trying to figure out a way to address this situation and maybe help these people out and encourage them to try to make their properties to where it doesn't lower the value of someone else's property, you know, and that would encourage people to want to come here and maybe, you know, rehab a house or something.
But it sounds like storms like tornadoes are a point of no return in Orrick, just like we were hearing that they are in Lucas.
Well, and, you know, we have had a couple of tornadoes hit here. But, you know, I think any community around, I mean, you have these issues that you deal with, or whether it's flooding like in Texas now, which hadn't happened for a long time. And so, yes, I think, and then you hear about it so much, you know, in the small community. When the tornado hit in 2014 on the south side of town, it affected almost every single house, and some of them very drastically, and others, you know, maybe not so much. But it was very difficult on our town, very, very difficult. It did a lot of damage to our school.
Yeah.
And we have a
Shirley,
wonderful school.
I've heard great things about your school. I want to turn back to Ryan McMakin. He wrote this article, America's Urban-Rural Divide Doesn't Really Exist, though he acknowledges that's putting it strongly. Ryan, what are you hearing in this? I mean, you've heard a lot of stories since we talked earlier in the show from both Kansas City's urban core and from small towns in the surrounding area.
Well, it really just it's helpful in highlighting these stories are helpful in highlighting some of these basic truths about real estate and how wrong it is when people repeat old myths like you should always invest in real estate because they're not making any more land and that sort of thing. The truth, of course, is that in lots of ways, the value of real estate can go to zero. And that's true in anywhere in the urban core. It could be true in rural areas. And in reference to the rural areas, it's that sort of problem you start to encounter when there isn't that economic base anymore. And then can you find something to replace it? So we know that compared to 100 years ago, so let's say back in the wheat boom back in the 19-teens, tons of people moved into, say, western Kansas, eastern Colorado, Nebraska Panhandle, and so on. So you had lots of farmers moving in there. You had thriving communities. They were moving wheat out. And then, but since the Second World War, the communities just get smaller and smaller. The average age of the people there gets higher and higher, and then they die, and then everyone lives hours away. And so the person you were talking to about, he's got his grandparents' home out there, but that's 3 or 4 hours away. He probably has to earn a living. So it's not practical for him to drive out there every weekend, and certainly not during the week. That's not even like the sort of thing you can make a round trip in a morning. And so the distance, the sheer distance, the time involved, the money of maintaining these properties, then unless you can come up with some way to earn a living out there or just not need to ever have to travel into a metro area to make a living, then it's just not practical for most people. And that's why we're seeing what the current trend is nationwide, and it's likely to continue for a few decades, is that people are moving out of the rural areas. They're moving into the metropolitan areas, not necessarily the city core, just somewhere in the metro area. It could even be one of those outer suburbs where it feels kind of country-ish.
Yeah, I mean, like, what about something like agritourism, which we were hearing so much about for a while? Like, in our area, there's this place called the Flint Hills, which, you know, as people rediscover the charms of that rustic prairie landscape, is that an opportunity when you see empty houses out in those areas? Like, could they become bed and breakfasts? I know I sound obsessed with bed and breakfasts.
Well, the question is, can you turn these places into a rural resort? And yes, I think that's everyone's dream, is if you're in one of these small towns, because then if you're connected to the small town, you can somehow turn it into a rural resort. Then what you'll do is you'll get people buying up second homes in that area and putting money in there. There will be a busy season where, say, during the summers, people will show up and spend a bunch of money and then they'll leave. And then the locals can actually just enjoy their own town and have money for a couple of months a year without the bother of the tourists. And then, of course, in the mountains, in the winter, you would have people there also for skiing and so on. So, yes, it can be done. You can somehow, in many cases, if you're in a picturesque location or there's some sort of feature there, like a lake.
I keep waiting for you to say but.
Spring. Well, but I guess the question is, is there enough money and interest in the world to turn every former rural community into a rural resort? And it doesn't seem that that is the case right now.
Well, I'm Gina Kaufman. We have to take one more break. There is just a little more time to get in on this conversation about abandoned homes at 816-235-2888. We want to talk about that issue in the city, in the country, wherever it's having an impact on your life. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Stay with us. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're talking about empty houses in the urban core and in small rural towns. Same problem, slightly different results, but really interesting to look at the two side by side and to look at this as a larger issue that involves places where people have left in large waves of migration for whatever reason. And now how do you deal with the houses that were left behind? We're here with Ryan McMakin, who's the author of an article called America's Urban-Rural Divide Doesn't Really Exist. He's also formerly an economist at the Colorado Division of Housing, so very knowledgeable about this topic. We also are joined in the studio by Margaret May. She's the executive director of the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Association. Hi again, Margaret.
Hello.
And hi to you, Ryan.
Hello, good morning.
So we're going to hear from some of our callers. Let's start with Michael, who is calling us from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I was calling because my parents inherited a home in the Santa Fe area.
They cannot maintain the home. Dad's 93, mom's 89, nursing home. But by the same token, I would love for a legacy to fix that home up. But it seems like in most cases, it's too much of a risk, because if you were to take a home like that and try to fix it up, there's no way that you could get any kind of grants, any kind of subsidies, unless you were planning on living in that home for a number of years, 5 years or more. So I think it's just too much of a risk in an area that's a food desert and all that, you know. So it seems like a person that would want to fix it up like me should have some kind of way to get some sort of subsidy, some sort of grant. It could be a really nice home for someone if you could get that type of help.
So, Ryan, is this a story that you hear a lot? I mean, that we had heard about the idea of inheritance and homes being something that you'd think about in a rural area. It sounds like Michael's talking about a metropolitan area.
Well, the metropolitan area makes it a little bit easier. You're better positioned in a metro area than in a rural area, simply because over time, people may start to see that metro area neighborhood, which is currently neglected, over time, as population fills in, that area is more likely to become an area of demand because it's relatively close to employment and people could imagine moving in there because they could still drive to their jobs.
So there's maybe some more optimism, but it sounds like he still perceives it as a risk. What about the idea of the risk that someone didn't really ask to take when they inherit a property?
Right. In the short term, I think you're encountering real problems in a lot of these cases where you have the old housing stock that's very expensive to maintain or need. Maybe it's going to, in many cases, what's probably going to end up happening over time is the house is simply going to be scraped. Someone's going to buy the lot and they're going to build a new house there. And but how long is that going to take? It seems as long as there's other options within, say, a similar driving distance, then you just have to wait until somebody decides that neighborhood's a place we want to gentrify next. But how long are you going to be waiting? And of course, the realities of human life are, if you don't have income, 10 years is a really long wait.
And what happens if someone like Michael owns the property and just doesn't see the value in doing anything with it?
Right. Well, I mean, that's perfectly rational. If there's no value to it in the large national trend, what we see is that people, they do walk away from these properties, or they sell them at very low prices to investors in many cases, which then, of course, leads to that other problem we were discussing earlier, where these absentee investors, then they may neglect the property themselves. And so there's all kinds of risks involved. And it's just a situation where the demand for that sort of property, that sort of real estate, has gone away, and you're left with what's essentially a white elephant, at least in the short term.
Let's talk to Keaton. Keaton's calling us from Midtown. Hi, Keaton.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. What can you share?
I just had something real quick. I work for an apartment company here in the Midtown area. My boss has bought a lot of houses, you know, kind of east where it may not be as desirable as right here in Midtown. And two in particular, there's one on Highland and one on Michigan that I think he went into having, you know, really good ideas, wanting to fix them up and either sell them or rent them. But what we've noticed is that every time it rains, it seems to be that there are people that just kick the doors in no matter how many times we try to fix it. And just the amount of money that it takes to put into these houses, it's just not really cost effective to try to do it, because you know, he may get the house for $2,000, then he'll turn around and have to spend $25,000 just to get it livable. And so I think a lot of people in this area are just trying to figure out how to actually get a return on something that seemed like it was a really good idea, but it just kind of snowballs when you keep trying to work on it.
Thanks for that call, Keaton.
Thank you.
And, you know, Margaret, I want to get you to respond to this. I mean, we heard also, we've talked to Ms. E, who we've referred to a few times on this show, and she mentioned to us the issue of break-ins. And is that something that people struggle with a lot as they try to take a place that had been in disrepair and make small incremental change to that place? Like, is it hard to get people to respect the property in its early stages of progress?
Well, what we do in Ivanhoe, we have actually restored several houses in the neighborhood, and we'll be doing more of those within the coming future. And we take the time to knock on the doors of the people that live on the block, introduce ourselves, let them know what we're planning to do with the house, and ask them if they will help us watch the house. We also get the houses insured, so if something does happen, you know, we don't have a total loss. And one of the observations on some of the comments that's been made, I'm very aware that quite often there's sentimental value that a person places on a house that their relatives or their parents owned. But you're really not giving honor to your parents if you let that house just sit. Vacant houses deteriorate very, very quickly. And it really is to the benefit of the neighborhood that's really trying to rebuild if that person is thoughtful in trying to find someone to buy it that will make a commitment to rehab it and get some people living in into the house.
So the sentimental thing to do is sell it.
We think that that's a better thing to do than just let it sit. And it appears to me that there are some people that collect houses just like people collect cars or shoes. And so some of the vacant houses is that situation.
Like it's someone's collection, like a monopoly board?
It's someone's collection. And while I understand, again, if there's sentimental value attached to that, I'm hoping that people will think about what effect is that having on the neighborhood. And many of the neighborhoods in the central part of the city really are working to become revitalized. And it is not helpful when there's a lot of vacant houses and vacant due to that kind of circumstance.
Is there a particular vacant house that you have dreams for, like in your wildest imaginings?
Well, there are a number of them in Ivanhoe because, again, the houses were built, many of them back in the 30s, very strongly built. And there's, yes, you must spend some money in order to bring them up, but I don't have a particular house, no.
Oh, I was hoping to hear a great dream. Ryan, chime in here. I mean, is this part of the national trend that you're seeing? Do you have insights onto a way out?
Well, I mean, part of the way out, well, at least psychologically, we could help ourselves by abandoning the idea that buying real estate is always an investment and that home prices always go up. Always is a really long time. And there's a certain feeling that, well, we have this house and I can't believe that nobody wants to put money into it. Really, when you buy a house, you're buying what's essentially a depreciating asset. Now, you don't notice it when you first buy it, because you're living there, you're keeping it up, and you're using it all the time, but at some point the depreciation starts to become a lot more obvious, and then you wake up one day and nobody wants to buy the house, and it becomes essentially worthless to the market in general. Now, of course, it has some value to certain families and so on, but its value isn't enough to cancel out the costs of maintaining that. So, to a certain extent, the reason we're having the discussion and why it surprises us so much is that we've been told for so long that it's always a good idea to invest in real estate, or that houses have some sort of intrinsic value when they really don't. And so we're at this point where, with a lot of housing stock, we've got to put a lot of money into it, or we got to get rid of it, and we have to make that decision.
So in order to stop abandoning houses, we have to abandon some ideas?
Well, I think we might see more people abandon them actually in the short term if people realize that this isn't an investment that's someday going to go back up in value. But some people might find themselves less trapped by their real estate if they're a little bit more cautious about viewing the real estate they buy as necessarily a safe investment.
Well, Ryan McMakin, author of America's Urban-Rural Divide Doesn't Really Exist, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Margaret May, Executive Director of the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Association, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We also talked today to John Hagmeister, Shirley Taylor, and Dale Fugate. You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow is a first Friday, and we're looking forward to all things arty in the month of September with a focus on quixotic dance, music from the Fantastics, and a play called Men on Boats from Missy Koontz. Don't miss that show tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Danielle Hogarty. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.